Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery, host of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have a special report on the state's landmark new housing laws and how they could impact communities in East County. Then on our Capitol Report, hear why local Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs voted against the Defense Reauthorization Bill. Hate crimes are on the rise, with some troubling incidents recently in East County. Hear how the district attorney's expert on prosecuting hate crimes is taking aim at perpetrators. The publisher of the Julian News has died after a battle with brain cancer, leaving the future of the town's newspaper at risk. At East County Magazine's Community Champions Awards presentation recently, Secretary of State Dr. Shirley Weber was among the recipients of the Brianna Gomez Award for Racial and Social Justice. You'll hear her stirring speech on today's show. Our newsmaker interview today is with State Senator Brian Jones. He'll be talking about several bills of his on the governor's desk and some just signed into law. Plus, hear his views on wildfire prevention, homelessness, crime, and more. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
This is Brian Schrader, reporting for East County Magazine. Last month, Governor Gavin Newsom signed two new housing bills into law. The main bill, titled SB 9, and its companion bill, SB 10, are the work of California Senator and San Diego native Tony Adkins. Together, the two bills represent the most sizable shift in California land use policy in recent decades. The first bill, SB 9, focuses exclusively on reforming single-family zoning. There are approximately 7.5 million single-family lots in California, and SB 9 gives homeowners two new options when it comes to building additional homes on their lot. The first provision allows homeowners to build an additional home on their property, a total of two homes per lot. The second provision allows homeowners to split their lot in two. Combined, these provisions allow for the construction of up to three additional units on a typical single-family lot when one home is already present. New units could either be attached to the main unit to form a duplex or be a detached granny flat. SB 9 also standardizes the rules for constructing additional units and introduces some measures to ensure that eligible lots are concentrated in urban areas and that homeowners control the process, not housing developers. The Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley estimates that approximately 10% of single-family lots in San Diego County are likely to undergo construction by their owners under the new law. Additional housing units are subject to new statewide regulations. While local regulations have allowed for the construction of granny flats, the most consequential provision of SB 9 could be lot splits. According to Stephen Dietz, a Los Angeles-based housing developer, lot splits enable new construction to be financed independent of the main house. He goes on to say that prior laws made building granny flats, or ADUs as they're called by legislators, often prohibitively expensive, and that independent financing could enable more ADU construction. As with every major change to California zoning law, the bill has so far been the target of praise by housing advocates and the cause for some concern among homeowners. Supporters say that the law helps generate additional housing for California's undersupplied housing market by allowing millions of Californians the option to build more housing in single-family neighborhoods. The bill's opponents argue that the law circumvents local control of zoning and could lead to overburdened residential infrastructure, a change in neighborhood culture, and a lack of parking. Provisions of the law exclude housing that is inside a historic district or homes that provide some types of affordable housing. Further provisions limit potential construction to lots within urban areas with at least 50,000 residents, along with other criteria. These criteria are together intended to ensure that new development under SB 9 is concentrated in areas where new housing is most needed. In a recent press release, the office of Senator Adkins stated that SB 9, quote, widens access to housing for California's working families and provides homeowners with more options to create intergenerational wealth. The other bill, SB 10, allows cities to streamline the process of converting single-family homes to developments with up to 10 units, if they are near transit. The bill would not apply to most of East County's backcountry. San Diego County's urbanized areas exclude any land east of Alpine, as well as areas with less than 50,000 residents, or less than 1,000 per square mile. These criteria ensure that new development is concentrated in urban areas, where new housing is most necessary. Together, the two bills mark the latest attempt by California legislators to address the state's housing crisis. Sandag estimates that the county needs over 170,000 new housing units by 2029 in order to meet demand, with about 16,000 of those units being built in East County. Among San Diego's congressional delegation, the votes on both bills were split mostly down party lines, with Democrats in favor and Republicans opposed. Though State Senator Brian Jones voted yes on SB 10 and no on SB 9, and Brian Mainschein did not vote.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Marie Johnson with the Capitol Report. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs is the only member of the San Diego congressional delegation who voted against the 2022 defense funding bill, which included a hefty military budget increase. Jacobs represents the 53rd congressional district, which includes portions of San Diego and East County. In a press statement, Jacobs states, "After 20 years of war in Afghanistan, it's unconscionable that so many of my colleagues have concluded that what we need is more money, more weapons, and more war. It's time to recognize that there are simply not military solutions to every problem." Jacobs objected to a $24 billion increase pushed by Republicans, which raised the final spending for defense to $768 billion. She says, "As a representative of San Diego, a proud and vibrant military community, I take seriously the responsibility to serve those who serve our country." But she adds, "Our service members and military families don't need a larger budget. They need their families to be taken care of and a government that goes through every diplomatic channel before making the decision to send them to war." San Diego's Republican representatives, Daryl Issa, as well as Democrats Mike Levin, Scott Peters, and Juan Vargas all voted in favor of the measure. The National Defense Authorization Act was approved 316-113, with 38 Democrats and 75 Republicans voting against it. Next up, the Senate must pass its own spending bill, followed by a reconciliation of the two versions between the two houses of Congress, before a final version will go to President Biden for his signature.
Hate crimes in California rose 30% in 2020 over the year before, according to Leonard Trin, lead hate crime prosecutor with the San Diego District Attorney. Trin shared stats during a forum on hate crimes in La Mesa on August 25th, where he also detailed hate crimes occurring in East County and efforts to prosecute those responsible. The forum was hosted by the city's Community Relations and Veterans Commission in partnership with La Mesa Conversations, the La Mesa Police, and the DA's office. Trin, the son of Vietnamese immigrants, recalled the fear and intimidation his own family experienced in Washington State after a neighbor destroyed Asian elements in the family's garden. He says of that experience, "It made me super aware of bias, prejudice, and stereotypes." Across the nation and here in San Diego County, there has been a rise in hate crimes for the past several years. The week after the 2016 election, when Donald Trump won the presidency, had the highest number of hate crimes ever recorded in the U.S., Trin said. Recent local hate crimes include the shooting at the Shabbat of Poway Synagogue, arson at an Escondido mosque, and incidents targeting black students at San Diego State University, including a hanging threat that was successfully prosecuted by the DA's office. Why the rise in hate crimes? One reason is that biases are now out in the open due to social media validating hateful beliefs. So what's being done to combat this trend? Locally, about half the cases prosecuted do end up in hate crime convictions, and most of the rest end up in convictions for other crimes. The number one reason for not prosecuting a case is because the victim can't identify who committed the crime, since these are often stranger-on-stranger offenses. Other reasons are mistaken ID, claims of self-defense, or insufficient evidence of actual bias. Some victims may not even report hate crimes due to fear of retaliation or fear of deportation or simply not wanting attention. Trin says the DA's office can't detain a victim for immigration purposes, and immigration status cannot be introduced in court either. The DA can take other steps to protect victims, such as asking media not to show a victim's face. It's also common to obtain protection orders prohibiting an accuser from contacting their victim. California's Penal Code defines hate crimes as crimes of bias due to physical or mental disability, gender, sexual orientation, nationality, race or ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation. The laws in other states vary widely, and three states have no hate crime laws on the books. Hate crimes may target an individual or a group, and an action can be prosecuted as a hate crime even if the perpetrator gets the victim's identity wrong. For instance, if someone attacks a Sikh wearing a turban because the attacker mistakenly believes the victim is Muslim, that's still a hate crime. The DA's office here recently prosecuted a case as a hate crime that involved a person who threw eggs at a reporter covering a Black Lives Matter protest, since the reporter was targeted for involvement with a racial group protected under state law. A hate crime is a felony. It can add 1 to 3 more years to a sentence for other crimes. If the defendant had a prior hate crime conviction, an extra year can be added. Committing a hate crime with someone else adds another 2 to 4 years. And hanging a noose or putting a terrorizing symbol of hate, such as a swastika, on someone else's property adds another year. Last year, 2/3 of all hate crimes in California targeted victims based on race, ethnicity, or national origin. Crimes against Asians increased in 2020 due to some people blaming COVID-19 on China and taking out frustrations on Asian Americans. But the largest number of hate crimes, over half, targeted the Black community. In 2019, over half of hate crimes were based on race, ethnicity, or national origin, with 20% based on religion and another 20% on sexual orientation. Crimes against Jews have also increased, as have crimes against transgender people, including 7 murders of trans women in 7 weeks nationally. At least 10 hate crimes have occurred in East County in the past decade. Trin gave several disturbing examples, including a 2018 attack with a handsaw at Applebee's in El Cajon against a person mistaken as a lesbian, a white power advocate in Lakeside who punched a Black security guard and rammed the entry with a vehicle, a threat to kill a Syrian family at Grossmont Center in La Mesa in 2019, a threat to burn a trans woman alive in El Cajon, a 2020 Lakeside assault on a Black woman with a board, and an assault this year on a Black teen in Lakeside by a defendant shouting racial slurs. Hate crime laws can also protect white people. One East County resident was charged with a hate crime for threatening to shoot a white neighbor after shouting racial slurs. In addition to hate crimes, Trin says, we've seen incidents of hate speech in East County in the past year. Obvious examples include shoppers who wore masks with swastikas and another who wore a KKK hood in Santee grocery stores. Those cases could not be prosecuted, since displaying such symbols alone is protected as free speech, and the wearers claimed they were protesting mask mandates. Similarly, a driver displaying a Nazi flag on Interstate 8 did not commit a crime, though Trin said, if he does anything illegal, we know who he is. Speech alone can sometimes be a crime, however, such as making a criminal threat or inciting violence. Now, to prove a hate crime, bias must be substantial against an individual or group protected by state law. Bias can be proven by looking at statements such as racial slurs made during the crime, but also by examining social media accounts and statements made by the defendant to law enforcement, even in the past. For instance, a medical student accused of a hate crime against an Uber driver locally had previously used profane language and racial slurs against a Mexican-American police officer. Hate symbols can help prosecutors prove bias when a crime occurs. Prosecutors look at tattoos, clothing, and even a defendant's room decor for symbols such as swastikas, Confederate flags, Nazi eagles, iron crosses, and white supremacist symbols such as the numbers 14 or 88, HH for Hail Hitler, SS bolts, or dual lightning emojis. Social media sites such as 4chan, 8chan, Discord, and Parler are favorites of hate crime criminals, said Trin, who warned parents that these sites, along with video gaming sites with chat, are being used by white supremacists to recruit children as young as 8 years old. Victims of hate crimes are urged to report them by calling 911 or your local law enforcement agency. Be sure to report any slurs and how often the assailant used them, along with a description of the suspect and vehicle, if possible, with license plate. Photos and videos are also helpful to prove that a hate crime occurred, but never jeopardize your safety. Victims can also contact the District Attorney's Victims Advocates at 619-531-4041. That number again, 619-531-4041. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Michael John Hart, longtime publisher of the Julian News, died September 14th after battling brain and lung cancer. His memorial services are slated for November. His wife, Michelle Harvey, confirmed Hart's passing on her Facebook page. She wrote, "Mike and I have so many friends. I am glad that we spent our lives working to help others." The newspaper has been for sale for months. Hart's death leaves the future of Julian's newspaper in limbo. A newspaper listing in July asked $300,000 for the publication, which was described as highly profitable despite pandemic lockdowns. Hart and Harvey acquired the independent weekly newspaper on July 4, 2004. The paper has been the voice of Julian since 1984. The newspaper also serves surrounding areas such as Ranchita and Ramona, as well as Julian, but suspended some operations in recent weeks due to Hart's illness. Running the newspaper has been a labor of love for Hart, who covered major news stories ranging from the 2007 Witch Creek fire that ravaged the region to controversies involving the county's acquisition of Julian's formerly all-volunteer fire department. Hart sometimes took heat for his coverage, but took pride in covering all sides of community issues, according to Harvey. Harvey told East County Magazine in an interview in July that her husband did 80 to 90% of the work running the paper, adding, "We've absolutely loved it. We wish we could do it for the rest of our lives." Several events are planned in Hart's memory. A celebration of life will be held on November 6th at 3 p.m. at Julian's Community Methodist Church. A memorial service is also slated on Tuesday, November 9th, Hart's birthday, at 11 a.m. at the La Mesa National Little League Field. In addition, a fundraiser to benefit Harvey is being planned at Winola Pizza and Bistro by his musician friends. A GoFundMe account set up earlier to help with Hart's medical bills is being continued to help Hart's family during this difficult time, according to Robin Boland, organizer of the fundraising page. On social media, community members reacted with sadness to news of Hart's passing, many also voicing concerns over the future of the town's primary newspaper. Michael John Hart was an avid supporter of arts and culture in Julian, Jason Polsternek writes. He came to all our shows. He will be sorely missed. Adam Paul called Hart a great person, then voiced the concerns of many, adding, "I hope someone buys the paper." Michael Judson Carr, the former publisher of the Julian News, stated that Michael John Hart, Michelle Harvey, and I could always relate about the value of community newspapers and being the best we could, knowing that no one else would tell the local story. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
This is Miriam Raftery, host and producer of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. On Saturday, September 25th, East County Magazine presented Community Champion Awards to people who have worked tirelessly to help others during the past very challenging year. Now, you'll be hearing from many of the winners on our upcoming shows in categories that include healthcare, public safety, environmental protection, and humanitarianism, as well as the Brianna Gomez Award for Racial and Social Justice. This special award is named for Brianna Gomez, our talented multicultural journalist whose life was tragically lost in a car accident recently. Brianna was passionate about reporting on racial and social justice issues in our region, and this award honors some amazing people who have achieved major accomplishments in fighting for racial and social justice. The three winners of the Brianna Gomez Award are Secretary of State Shirley Weber, who is also our former assembly member, the Reverend Shane Harris, leader of the People's Alliance for Justice Advocates and also an advocate for foster youths, and Buki Domingos, founder of the San Diego Racial Justice Coalition and an advocate for victims of human trafficking. Secretary of State Weber gave a speech after accepting her award in person, which we'll be sharing with you on today's show. The daughter of sharecroppers in Arkansas during the segregationist Jim Crow era, Dr. Shirley Weber is an American success story, but she also knows firsthand the importance of civil rights and voting rights. Her grandfather never voted due to laws that suppressed voting by blacks. Her father left Arkansas after he was threatened by a lynch mob and could not vote until he was in his 30s. Raised in California since age 3, Dr. Weber earned her bachelor's, master's, and PhD degree by age 26. She taught at colleges, including San Diego State University, where she retired as chair of the Department of Africana Studies. She also served as chair of the San Diego Unified School District. Elected to represent California's 79th Assembly District, which includes much of East County and San Diego, she was a powerhouse in the legislature. She chaired the California Legislative Black Caucus and also chaired many committees, including the Assembly Budget Committee, the Elections and Redistricting Committee, a committee to address campus hate crimes, a subcommittee on public safety, and a committee on higher education in San Diego County to improve access to affordable higher education. Her legislative accomplishments include major reforms in criminal justice and education, improving transparency and reporting on police use of force, addressing racial profiling, predatory lending, inclusive jury selection, ethnic studies, restorative justice, health reforms, and legislation to help senior citizens, veterans, and military families. She has a passion for equality and fairness and has fought tirelessly to expand civil rights for all Californians. In January, she was appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom to become California's first Black Secretary of State, where she is now working to protect voting access for us all. And now, let's hear Dr. Weber's speech presented during our Community Champions Awards.
Thank you so much. I'm always honored to be at home. San Diego is my home, and so when I get a chance to be at home and with folks who live in this county, I feel truly blessed. I want to thank you for this recognition tonight. I want to thank the press, the independent press. It's extremely important in these very difficult and trying times to try to get correct information to people. The misinformation, the campaigns for misinformation are notorious across the nation. And we are struggling always to make sure that people get the correct information so they can make the decisions that are beneficial to them and to their families. And so I want to thank that press because you've always been a force. The East County Magazine has always been a force. And I've always relied upon you for good information and basically not only the information, but the help that you give to so many. And so we're honored tonight to be here with you. Let me just say that I had never in my life ever expected to be Secretary of State. Ever. And I want to emphasize that because when you're a kid who's raised in the Pueblos, the projects of Los Angeles, and your father went as far as the fifth grade and your mother as far as the ninth grade, because that's all they would allow them to have in Hope, Arkansas. Your dreams are sometimes stifled and limited in terms of what you see in the world around you. My father was adamant about us standing up for ourselves. And he stood up for himself and almost cost his life in Arkansas. But he was adamant about us being proud of ourselves and standing up for ourselves and fighting for education and fighting for those who didn't have the strength to fight for themselves. And so ingrained in my family has always been the spirit of giving. And like I said, coming out of that environment and being able to be blessed in California to go to UCLA and to get 3 degrees from UCLA and only owe $1,250. That in itself was a gift from California to me. And so it breaks my heart when I see the cost of higher ed, when it breaks my heart to see that sometimes we are locking out our students. And so my journey to the Assembly was really based on the fact that I had been recruited by Toni Atkins because she said, we don't have an educator in the Assembly right now. We don't have anyone who knows K-12 and post-secondary like you do, and we need an extra voice. And so I went to the Assembly to really to be a voice for justice for kids and education, and I did that for a number of years. But justice doesn't always stop just at the schoolhouse. It goes to our families, it goes to those in need, it goes to those without, it goes to the streets when people are being mistreated, it goes into our jailhouses and all those things. And so I spent the majority of my career basically in the Assembly fighting for justice. We had 180,000 people in prison when I went to the Assembly. We now have 90,000. We had no focus on rehabilitation and providing individuals with skills to basically rebuild their lives once they came out. And we did that. And we'll continue to do that because that's the right and just thing to do for our families, for those who've been incarcerated, who made mistakes. I believe in the second chance and the third chance. And most folks do if it's their own relative, but maybe not for others. So I want to thank you for this opportunity to be with you this evening. The challenge of being Secretary of State was offered to me by the governor and his staff, which I, like I said, I did not apply for the job. Others had wanted it. And I think what impressed them most was the fact that they know I'm a woman of integrity, that I fight for what's right and just, that I will not bend the rules or break the rules for anyone. And some of you saw that in the recall election when the governor who appointed me sued me. But that was okay, because I was going to stand for you, stand what was right and what was just, and make sure that process, that election process, was fair and honest and transparent. And I will continue to do that. And I continue to say, people, that I understand what it's like when you can't vote, when people deny you the right to vote. I understand the impact it had on my family, my parents. But I also know what happens when you have nothing to vote for, when the people who represent you are not really your voice, who will not carry the agenda, and who will not be bold enough to stand up for you. And so I've always worked in the 79th Assembly District to make sure that everyone had a chance to vote, that everyone had a right to vote, that we open up the franchise of voting to everyone. And right now, about 90% of all of those eligible to vote now are registered to vote. We've been registering since I've been in the office, and that's a major portion of what we're doing to basically register every Californian. We've done about 11% increase in our voting registration right now, and we're almost at 90% of all eligible voters in California who are registered to vote. And so I understand what happens when you can't vote, as I said, and I understand when you have nothing to vote for. And so I've always been a legislator who's going to basically address the hard issues, the difficult issues, the ones that nobody else wants to pick up and fight for, and I fight for those issues because those are the issues that people want. And it's not time to be political or politically correct and not address the issues that are on all of our hearts and the needs of our families. So let me thank you this evening for this award. I was impressed. I had heard about Brianna, and I was impressed to hear her family. And I feel like I lost myself. I lost. I didn't get a chance to meet her personally, but she had the kind of spirit of giving and the free spirit that she lived a million years, obviously in 1 year, that she did more than most folks do in a lifetime. And your family's to be proud of that fact, that she did not waste her time on this earth doing frivolous things, that she made an impact every day. And as I said, some folks live forever. They tell me Methuselah lived 700 or 900 and stuff, whatever it was, years. And the Bible says, and then he died. That was it. Didn't say he did anything in the process of those all those years. It just said Methuselah lived 797, whatever years it was, and died. And meanwhile, there are other folks who live their life to the maximum. And the things that they do impact all of us, and we will remember it forever, whether they live 30 years or 40 years or 800 years or just a few years. What they do to us and how they impact our lives and prick our hearts, make us strong. And I want to thank you for this recognition this evening. And I will always live with Brianna on my mind, that there are those folks who make a difference. And all of us have the capacity to do what she did, which is to work hard and to give people a chance and to make sure that the spot that you sit in is always better when you leave. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the recognition.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, we're very honored to have with us my special guest, State Senator Brian Jones. He represents California's 38th district, which includes most of East County from El Cajon all the way out to Anza Borrego and north to Palomar Mountain. As a Republican and a member of the minority party in Sacramento, Senator Jones has actually been successful in getting several bills passed that are now on the governor's desk awaiting signature or that have just been signed into law. He's here today to talk about those measures as well as some other hot topics of interest, both locally and statewide. Senator, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Miriam. I'm glad to be on. Thank you for making time for me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. So, before we delve into the details of the bills, I'd like to ask, what do you attribute your success to in clearly being able to work across the aisle to get some bills through a Democratic-controlled legislature, some of them even unanimously?
Right. Well, a big part of it is, you know, building relationships with as many of my Democratic colleagues as I can. You know, that's obviously helpful. Of course, I ran some bills this year that didn't make it out of committee.
Sure.
You may remember my religion is essential bill, but that was an important bill to just raise awareness of the condition of the pandemic at that point in time.
Yeah.
But, you know, bills that are going to pass, it's based on relationships with the committee chairman, the committee members. And then, of course, you know, when the governor signs them, making sure that my staff and the governor's staff are communicating regularly on the importance of the bills and what they do and the positive difference it will make, not just for the constituents in my district, but statewide.
Yeah, no, that's so important, that building relationships across the aisle. I think not demonizing everybody else. I mean, obviously, there's legitimate criticism of things in both parties, but
right.
Acting respectfully toward others. And that's something that I think you've always done fairly well.
Newt Gingrich expressed a frustration once when he was Speaker of the U.S. House, in that most Republicans, when they get elected, they speak conservative, but vote moderately when they get to the House that they're voting in. And he said, I would prefer for Republicans to speak moderately and vote conservative. And so I've tried to follow that as much as possible, as it's productive in Sacramento.
Well, we certainly hear the same criticism of Democrats who sometimes get what they thought they were voting for the other way. Let's talk about your specific bills, though, which really have broad appeal, I think, across party lines, which is unusual these days. Senate Bill 400, I understand this implements the recommendation of the state auditor for the Department of Education to work with local schools to better identify homeless students and, you know, help them get the help that they need. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. You may remember when I was in the Assembly, I served on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. The Senate and the Assembly approved the auditor's projects. And so as a result of that, I've always kind of kept an eye on what the auditor is, when she does her reports, what she's reporting out on, the recommendations that she's making on different issues. And this is one of the ones that my staff identified as an important issue, not just in my district, but statewide. And so we know that as homelessness has continued to be a challenge here in California, a lot of unfortunate folks that are caught up in that are students, high school students. And this is giving an opportunity for us to make a positive impact on students that are homeless, and making sure we're identifying who those students are and getting them plugged in to the proper services that are available to them through the state agencies and the county agencies.
Yeah, so that includes meals, housing, counseling, all kinds of different things.
That's correct.
Yeah, very good. I know I was kind of shocked to hear how many homeless students have actually been camping out on our local community college campuses, for instance. Is it only high school, or does it also include other levels?
Oh, no, it's students across the board.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Yeah. And Senator Jones' bill to help homeless students has been signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. Senate Bill 549, this one makes sure that in future pandemics, or maybe also in the current one, that social workers will be declared essential workers to be prioritized to receive personal protective equipment, or PPE, like masks and gloves. It's kind of shocking that they didn't already have this.
Well, this bill was born out of a committee hearing that we had through the Human Services Committee, an informational hearing we had back in the fall. And we had a witness from LA County, a social worker, testify that, get this, 33,000 foster kids in LA County alone that had completed every step and every element that they needed to complete to go to their adoptive homes, but weren't able to because of two reasons. One, the social worker wasn't able to come out to do their final interview because they couldn't get the PPE. And second, the courts were closed and not processing these cases for these kids to go to their forever home. And so I about blew a gasket on the dais that day.
Good
and as a result of that, we came back, proposed this bill to make sure that in future emergency situations, when social workers are declared essential, that they have access to the proper equipment they need to do their job. Once we introduced it and got through its first committee hearing, SEIU and the U.S. Social Workers Association came on as sponsors and wanted to help with the bill. And so we've been able to get that bill through both houses and now sitting on the governor's desk.
Very good.
And it's not something you would normally see my name on, but as a result of that committee hearing, I just felt compelled to make sure that this isn't something that happens again.
Yeah, it shows there is compassionate conservatism still in some members of the legislature.
I like that term.
Yeah. Senate Bill 578, another bill that implements a state auditor's recommendation. This one would say that most conservatorship hearings should be held in a closed hearing unless a court specifically finds a public interest overriding privacy of family members involved. I have to say, I was a little bit surprised to learn that these aren't already closed. We're talking about things like maybe somebody's being declared mentally incompetent, right. Perhaps an elderly person with Alzheimer's. It's already tough enough for a family to have to go to court to make sure their interests are properly protected. And the idea that that could be a public record, I think, might dissuade some people from even doing it.
Well, not only public record, Miriam, but public access, to the proceedings. So this, again, the law was vague in this particular situation. The auditor pointed that out. Mm-hmm. So we took this up as privacy, is important to me, working on the cancer registry information that we've worked on in the past and other things. And so we introduced this bill. We've had very little opposition. We had to work with the LA juvenile court system to work out some things that they were, thought they were already doing to comply with it. But at the end of the day, we were able to get everybody on board and again, get this on the governor's desk. And it just basically says that if somebody's coming to court for conservatorship hearing, the hearing must be closed to the public unless the judge under a body of evidence agrees that the public interest is served by it being open, then the judge can compel the hearing to be open. And that would be a very rare an odd case for something like that to happen.
I think so. Like maybe if it's a public official or something like that.
Maybe,
where there's a political motivation to try to get someone declared crazy or something.
You got all kinds of names ringing around in my head right now. I'm just kidding. No, I'm kidding.
I can imagine. Yeah. There you go.
And we should add that the conservatorship bill has also been signed by the governor. Another bill deals with child labor trafficking, Senate Bill 584, and it would add child labor trafficking to the list of topics that foster families must receive training and information about. Obviously, human trafficking is an enormous issue in our area. Some may not know that places like Lemon Grove and Spring Valley are actually human trafficking hubs in the whole nation, and yet so many parents and foster parents are unaware. So tell us a little bit more about that one.
Well, last year, this was originally included in another bill that dealt with sex trafficking training for foster parents. The author ran into some roadblocks and pulled this part of the bill out. So that bill did get passed and signed into law dealing with sex trafficking. And we worked with that author this year and got this language put back in as a single bill. And we're hoping that the governor will agree with this and agree that labor trafficking is also a challenge for foster kids. And we want to make sure that foster families' parents are trained on how to identify and protect their foster kids from this activity.
Very good. You also had a couple of bills that are described as technical in nature, SB 414. I guess that one the governor actually signed in July.
That was signed in July for the land surveyors, correct? Yeah. That's just a cleanup in the code that manages their license.
Okay. And then there's also Senate Bill 534, which is another code cleanup measure. This one co-sponsored by the California Dental Hygienists Association.
And that's, again, a technical cleanup to their licensing code. I serve on the Business and Professions Committee. So every once in a while, we'll have the different licensing associations come to us, to clean up function of their licensing law.
Well, let's talk about another hot topic now, no pun intended, but that is fire safety.
Right.
Much on the mind of everybody, I think, in the state as we're looking at another year of just these record firestorms burning across.
Unbelievable.
You think it can't get worse, and it seems like it always does. But you have raised some concerns, I understand, about the state's wildfire prevention efforts. Senator Jones, do you think that Governor Newsom and CAL FIRE, which has the funding for this, have done enough to prevent these devastating fires?
Well, Miriam, that's the problem. In this year's budget, we're spending billions of dollars on suppression of fires, so fighting the fires, which is CAL FIRE's job, but we're only spending millions on the prevention and the clearing. And so we've got to, in California, change the mindset of the environmental lobby, really is what it comes down to. That we cannot continue to not thin the forests and not do proper forest management.
I would throw in here that interestingly, the federal government just changed their policy on that. We heard President Trump talking about raking the forest, which may have been an oversimplification. But nonetheless, under the Biden administration, they've now just authorized the Forest Service earlier this year to do a lot more clearing on federal forest lands to hopefully prevent more situations like the devastating Paradise Fire that started on forest land. But now the problem in the state, as I understand it, is Capital Public Radio did a pretty good job of an investigative report talking about the governor sort of overpromising wildfire prevention efforts. Right. He talked about 35 priority projects for fire prevention on 90,000 acres, but at least as of late June, only about 11,000 of those acres actually had the work done. And in 2020, granted it was a pandemic year, the number of acres treated actually dropped sharply from the year before. So what's your take on that report?
Well, it tells me that the governor has not properly made this a priority. He's continued to give attractive sound bites to make us think that, you know, California is managing this properly. I just did a tour on the North Coast up near Mendocino on some of the redwood forests and, you know, showing the or visiting and seeing the difference between a properly managed forest with proper thinning so that the trees can be managed for growth. And then a forest that wasn't properly managed, it is just a tinderbox waiting to go up. And here's my frustration with the environmental lobby in California is, you know, they want to keep arguing that it's to protect the environment that we don't thin these trees out. But at the same time, they're also making arguments to end fossil fuel burning engines to protect the environment from emissions. One of these forest fires wipes out an entire year to a decade of auto emissions savings. And one of the larger forest fires has wiped out 100 years worth of industrial emissions protection. And so there's some hypocrisy amongst the environmental lobby on this particular issue that I think most Californians are beginning to see through.
Yeah, and also the wildlife. You look at the devastating loss of wildlife when we have a forest burn, and now even things like redwood trees that are thousands. These are trees that go back to, you know.
Right now in California, we are working to protect the sequoias in the Sequoia National Park because there's a forest fire near Sequoia. And because of the heritage and value of those trees, when I say value, I mean historical value and not as a dollar value, but just what it means to California to have these forests there. We're taking unbelievable, extreme, hard labor measures to protect these trees, where if we had just thinned the forest around them over the last 10 years, they'd already be safe.
Yeah, it's worth noting the Native Americans have done that for tens of thousands of years.
Right, you know? Exactly.
Cap Radio did speak with Tom Porter, who's the CAL FIRE spokesman, and asked him how come so few of these clearing projects have been done. The reasons he gave, he attributed to several things. One of them, as you mentioned, is a lack of environmental approvals, also approvals from landowners in some cases. Another is the COVID-19 pandemic, which hit CAL FIRE hard. There have actually been a lot of CAL FIRE fighters down with COVID or quarantining because of exposure. At one point, the majority of their pilots were actually grounded, which is scary. And the last being the early start to what's turned out to be the worst fire season on record. So it pretty well led to, according to them, an all hands on deck approach just to fight the fires, never mind getting out and clearing things to prevent more fires.
Correct. Let's keep in mind that CAL FIRE's main job is to suppress fire, not prevent fire.
Yes.
So it's going to require some major funding resources from the state and contractors that the state now, and then, and if CAL FIRE manages it, I'm fine with that. I think CAL FIRE administration does a good job with what they're tasked with, but, you know, currently they're not tasked with clearing major portions of the forest. And back to your point on private property versus government property, most of the forest in California that's in danger is on U.S. Forest Service land. And so we need to get the U.S. Forest Service to clear out their dead trees. You know, Miriam, there's areas of the Sierras where 20% of the trees are dead, not dying, dead. And that's one out of five trees is already standing, but dead. And as a tinderbox, when fire hits that, they literally explode.
And it's so frustrating. It's not a new problem. I remember, I don't know if you remember back that far, but just before the 2003 Cedar Fire here, we had bipartisan signatures from San Diego's, I believe it was the entire congressional delegation, pleading with, I think back then it was it President Bush, anyway, to
would have been, yeah,
clear the forest, right. to clear the forest out here in Cleveland National Forest, where the bark beetles were taking a toll. Yep. There were all these
trees.
And the answer finally came back, no. And that was like, I want to say a day before the Cedar Fire
right.
broke out, after months of sitting on the desk of some bureaucrat back in Washington who decided to do
exactly.
nothing. And so why haven't we learned from that? The same thing is still happening under every administration.
It's hard to get bureaucrats and politicians to learn from those kinds of mistakes, I guess. You know, some of us remember, and you know, I drove through, that was a year after I got elected to the Santee City Council, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
When that fire burnt through Muth Valley.
Our publisher lost his house in Muth Valley.
So I drove through that area with the Santee fire chief. And that was my first experience with that type of fire and witnessing it firsthand. And when we were driving out El Monte Road, it was still burning and deer literally jumped in front of our car and over the fence as we were driving through to see what was going on. So it's, sorry for the pun, but burned into my memory and is not something I'll ever forget. And because it's my district, you know, in San Diego, the most fire prone district in San Diego County is my district.
Yeah.
And so it is important to me. And that's why I continue to fight for these issues and working across the aisle in a bipartisan manner with my colleagues to move the needle as much as I can.
Yeah. Some issues should just transcend party lines. We should all care about whatever we need to do for fire safety. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, another fire-related issue here. A lot of our readers are very concerned about losing their fire insurance out here now.
Yeah, and that's a function of a couple of things. One, the danger of living in the rural areas, in the fire-prone areas. Two, the state not allowing the forest to be thinned like they ought to be. And then three, the Department of Insurance under Prop, I think it was 103 originally, that put the insurance commissioner's office into an elected position under the DOI, not allowing the insurance companies to manage their rates so that they can have a viable business plan. And so as these fires burn down more and more expensive areas of the state, the fire insurance companies are looking at this going, we can't service these areas and stay in business. And so we've got to allow some creativity on those three points, getting the wildfire danger down in California.
The state has spent $13 billion or so in recent years attempting to tackle the homelessness crisis, which of course has only been exacerbated by the pandemic and, you know, people losing jobs and facing evictions. What are your thoughts on how the money was spent, Senator? And I understand that in a prior legislative session, you had introduced a package of what you referred to as solution-oriented homelessness reforms. Can you talk a little bit about your ideas on homelessness? And do you have any plans to try any of your bills again next year?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that we need to, I think, keep in mind as a guiding principle for dealing with homelessness, the easier you make it to be homeless, the more homeless you're going to get. And what that's done for us in California is, you know, California, I think, is 12% of the U.S. population. But we have almost, a couple of years ago, it was 33%. And I think we're getting close to 50% of the entire homeless population of the entire country is in California. So California has 33% of the homeless population in America, and all 49 other states have the other 67%.
Wow.
And so obviously whatever we're doing wrong. And one of those things is continuing to throw money at the problem without having accountability for the programs that we're throwing that money to. With Room Key and Home Key, and we allow him to show one or two situations where that's working, we let him get away with, and I say we, the legislature, and the media, the press, allow him to get away with walking away from the hundreds of stories where those two situations don't work. And then, of course, the Housing First idea that started this in the first place, giving somebody a home to live in without any accountability on getting themselves healed from whatever situation is causing their homelessness in the first place.
So you're talking things like addiction or alcoholism, mental health issues,
illness. And you know, I think Miriam, you and I, and most Californians would agree that those that are down and out, financially and have run into some tough times deserve the help and should get the help. And in California right now, that's a minority number of the homeless people. And for a single mom or a single dad that are just down on their luck, lost their job, living out of their car with one kid or two kids, or even no kids for that matter, mm-hmm. but want help, the resources are there for those people that want the help and want to get out of that situation. And I think California, for the most part, and the locals, the counties and the local agencies that help those homeless people are fairly successful in allowing that to happen. Where we drop the ball is in the situation where the homeless person is either mentally ill, addicted, or maybe recently released from incarceration without a proper home to go to. And now we're starting to see low-level petty crime increase because we've removed the penalties for those crimes. We've created, and I say we, I got to be straightforward and honest here, Miriam. It's the democratically controlled legislature and the Democrat governor that their policies that have put us in this situation. Republicans come to the table every year with ideas that should work if we were given the opportunity to implement them. But unfortunately, our ideas are always held up in committee. And I would say the underlying principle of the Republican ideas is a carrot and a stick. We're going to give a carrot to those that want to get out of the homeless situation and have chosen to get out of the homeless situation and take advantage of the resources that are available through the state and the counties to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly committed on our show to airing a variety of voices and a variety of views so that people can hear the arguments on all sides and make up your own mind, listeners, on, you know, on what you agree with.
And I don't know, Miriam, the last time you've driven by my district office here in El Cajon, but today, right now, I have a homeless tent pitched across the street from my, and it's a fairly good size one. Mm-hmm. And then if you drive down the street next to my district office behind the Home Depot, there's a row of homeless tents set up right now.
Yeah, and El Cajon has a big homelessness problem.
Right. The sheriff's department will allow those to be there for a period of time. The El Cajon police will allow the one across the street from me to be there for a period of time. And then they'll come through and clean it up. And those people move on to another location. They'll be there for a period of time. And then the law enforcement will come. But the legislature and the governor have taken the tools away from the local police by minimizing penalties on low level crime to where the police can't even arrest these folks and compel them to get better.
Yeah, I do hear that from legislators in El Cajon, also council members who've told me that there's been issues of things like people stealing things that they can use as tent poles from local stores. Right. And there doesn't seem to be anything that they can do about it. So it is an issue.
I want to be very clear on one point because, you know, I get it that Republicans get accused of not being compassionate on this particular issue. Miriam, I want these people to get better. And I think my Republican colleagues want these people to, and my Democrat colleagues do too want them to get better.
What is the answer? If someone has, say, mental illness and they don't think they need help, is the answer to just keep sweeping away the tents? Or how? It's very hard in California to force somebody into mental health treatment.
Right. So
if they don't want it.
At some point in time in California, as a society, we're going to have to make the decision, the societal decision, that compassion means not allowing somebody to live on the street in these types of conditions. And we're going to have to find a way to humanely compel them to take care of themselves and use the resources that are already available to them to do that. And sometimes that means going to jail. And sometimes that means doing community service as the stick, what I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And we can do that compassionately, Miriam. It doesn't have to be like the old days. There's new modern techniques to compelling somebody to take care of themselves. And if it's the drug addiction, they've got to go to a program and get well and get off their drug addiction. And right now, the legislature and the governor is moving in a direction where if you're a drug addict, they are making it easier for you to live on the street and be a drug addict and stick poison in a needle up your arm rather than go get better. I would prefer to take the course of compelling them to go get better.
Speaking of crime and public safety, you voiced a concern, I understand, about the rise in homicides, which went up 31% last year. It's interesting. I'm looking at crime rates from the Department of Justice as of July of this year for all of last year, and it's kind of strange, actually, because some things, homicides went way up 31%, and yet other violent crimes like rapes decreased 8%, violent crimes overall increased a little less than 1%. Vehicle thefts, wow, up almost 20%. And the really scary one is arson rate up 43%. What's that all about? How do we stop that?
So, Miriam, one thing I would request, and we can do the research on, obviously. I know the answer. But any of those crime statistics that went down, one of the things you have to look at is, prior to that, did the legislature decriminalize that activity? So, for example, Prop 57 raised the grand theft limit from $450 to $950. So as a result of that, you're going to see last year less of that crime, but this year you're going to see more because now people, once they get used to stealing $950, next year they're going to steal more because they're getting away with it. So that, we're going to start seeing more increase in that. Homicides, we didn't decriminalize homicides. So that's, that's why you're seeing that number go up because actually there was more homicides. There's more petty crime in California. It's just not being reported because it's not a felony anymore. Cops aren't going to write a citation for misdemeanor theft because they just know that the person's not going to show up. They're not going to pay the cop's not going to waste their time with the paperwork. They got other things to go do than waste their time giving a citation they know is going to not be enforced. So you got to watch those statistics on everything that's fallen. On did that crime really fall or did it get re?
Sure. Like with decriminalizing marijuana, obviously drug crime's down, but that's just because smoking a joint isn't a crime anymore.
Exactly. Bingo.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you would like to add for our listeners today, Senator Jones?
Sure. Miriam, one of the most often questions I get is, what do you do up in Sacramento? How do you deal with all of this? And how do you get anything done? And I'll tell you one of the things, Miriam, that we're, and you've witnessed this with some folks that you've sent to us. One of the things that I take the most pride in my staff is the constituent work that we do in the office. We have over 2,500 cases that we've done over the last 18 months, just in EDD, people that were trying to get their unemployment benefits and couldn't because EDD wouldn't answer their phone. And somehow they learned to reach out to us and let us help them.
I'll give a shout out to your staff, Lori, especially. She's helped me a couple times with DMV issues. I got hung up where I couldn't get the global entry pass, for a trip. They took one look and said, oh, you're a journalist. We don't want you traveling to Mexico. I wasn't going to report on caravans. I was going on a wine tasting trip, was crazy. And even if I was reporting on caravans, shouldn't we be able to do that?
Absolutely.
They were denying me based on a car I used to own. And yet my husband was a co-owner of the same car where there was some issue with the paperwork, whether it was filed or not. It turned out it was. And I said, well, you approved his and you didn't approve mine. This is discriminatory. Right. And she got it straightened out for me with the DMV. But it was just craziness. Call the DMV and they're closed for the pandemic. What do you do?
She's been
wonderful on so many different things through the years for so many people that I know.
Well, good. And I appreciate you recognizing that. If there's anything that the constituents need as far as service with a state agency or federal agency, we'll point them in the right direction. But we're here to help. My staff is here to help. I have one of the most professional staffs in the state and the most effective as far as getting constituent work done. And that's what we're here for. That's our biggest point of pride.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show and Pond 5. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.